Kane is in the building.
Guys, you know how much we love Liberty shirts. Their flannels are unbelievable, and when we were job hunting, we wore Liberty shirts for our interviews and now to work every day. We thought Liberty was our secret until we started seeing their shirts on TV on Fox Sports every Saturday and Sunday. Now we know they are for real, but they are still our secret. Save 10% on your order when you enter the promo code 3PEAT at checkout.
Hello, and welcome back to another 3PEAT podcast episode, season 4, episode 10. I am your host, Josh Fromowitz, and joining me once again are my co-hosts,
Steven Benazzo
and Alex Castle.
And joining us this week, as we mentioned last week, is a special guest, Alan Hahn. Alan, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here, guys.
We're thrilled to have Alan joining us. He is a studio analyst for the New York Knicks on MSG Network, and he's a talk show host on ESPN Radio with former NFL player Bart Scott, one of my favorites of all time. And Alan, the first question I got for you is, how'd you get involved in the industry, in the sports media industry?
Well, I mean, right out of college was, and, you know, I say that, I tell this story all the time because, you know, a lot of guys your age don't understand a world without what we're doing right now. And, you know, just the idea of the internet. The idea of websites, none of that. When I was in college, I played basketball. And the only thing that, you know, the only thing that was in your future as somebody like me who was a journalism major was a newspaper. You know, it was either, you know, the New York newspapers, Sports Illustrated, or, you know, you would have to get into, which there wasn't really, it was one sports talk radio station. And then there was, you know, being a commentator, like a play-by-play, you know, guy. And it was, there just wasn't availability. You know, there wasn't like what we have today, which is there's podcasting, there's websites. There's a million ways you can go now in this genre that didn't exist. So when I was in college, I never thought about doing TV. I never thought about doing radio. I like to write, but I was like, I'll be honest with you, I was a dumb jock. I just was a basketball player. Like, I didn't, you know, if you asked me when I was in high school what I wanted to do for a living, I was, well, I want to play basketball as long as I can. And when I was in college, I had that same thing. I kept telling myself, I'm going to play overseas. If I'm not an NBA player, I kind of knew that pretty quickly. So I thought I'd be good enough to play overseas. Had injuries that really pretty much ended my career. And then I had to make a decision. Well, what are you going to do? Well, I like to write. I always read, you know, the newspaper, the coverage of the Jets and the Knicks and the Yankees, the Islanders. Those were my teams. And I just thought, well, all right, I can't play, but maybe I can write about it. So that was my major. I kind of wrote for the school paper and nothing else. Like, I didn't really do anything, you know, I didn't have a direction. So when I graduated college, I worked for this company called Electronic Arts. I got a job through a friend of mine, and you don't know, not sure if you guys know what Electronic Arts is today, but when I tell you, you're going to go, holy crap. So Electronic Arts was a startup company in the Silicon Valley in California that made computer games, you know, like for the PC mostly. And one of their computer games was a game called John Madden Football. And I took a job with them. They did a sports division that they were starting and they wanted to do a lot of promotion for it. They had a new game called PGA Tour Golf and a game called Lakers versus Celtics. And then they had John Madden Football. And there was a Nintendo 8-bit system, a Sega 8-bit system. This is the Sega 16-bit right here. But they started making cartridge games, and they changed. They had Electronic Arts as one. Oh, I'm sorry. They also had a game called NHL Hockey. So the year I started, they had a division that was now called EA Sports. And they had games like NHL 94 and, you know, the Lakers, Celtics that turned into what all the champions were until it became NBA Showdown. And John Madden Football became Madden. And all that, you know, and eventually PGA Tour Golf turned into Tiger Woods Golf. But that was beyond me. So I was there for a year and I thought, you know, I don't know what I'm doing, but this is fine. And I did it for about a year, and it was kind of a go nowhere kind of job. It felt like it was just a lot of, there's like demoing games. Like I played in front of the whole company. I played the CEO in a demo of the new golf game, which I had played before because back then, it's all I did all day was play games, drink beer and hang out. And I destroyed him. Right in front of the whole company. I mean, just embarrassed them. And I thought it was a feather in my cap. Like, I showed that I'm good at your game. Apparently, he didn't like, you know, that wasn't the right thing to do. So it didn't go over well. So any advancement in that company was pretty much, and it was a company of a couple hundred people at the time. So eventually, like, I realized I was going nowhere. So it's like a year later, and I came back to New York, and, you know, I was going to try to do stuff in New York for them. And then my boss was like, I don't think it's working out. So I had this option that I could keep my stock in the company, which they gave you as sort of, they couldn't really afford to pay a lot. So they gave you these stocks that you'd get. And I was like, nah, I'll cash them in. So I got like a couple of $1,000, which a friend of mine who works in Wall Street told me like about 15 years ago. He's like, oh yeah, that stock would have been worth about $800,000. It's like, my God. So anyways, from there, it's like, so just wanted to show you how I really didn't have a direction, but I had a journalism degree and I thought, let me give this a shot. And I was like, you know, closely following the Knicks, you know, the Jets, very closely, those two teams. And I followed the coverage and knew all about it. So I couldn't get a job anywhere in the country. Every single paper, you know, wanted, did you have an internship? No, never did. You have any clips? Don't have any clips. How am I going to get a job? I don't know. So I just thought the one place that knew me, well, I went to the Hamptons, who had like a weekly paper. It was out once a week, and they had, the guy was willing to hire me for like, I believe it was like $25 a story. And it was, you know, they have a couple of high school teams out there. And hey, why don't you just during the winter live in the Hamptons and cover high school sports? The Hamptons is great in the summer, but not in the winter. There's nothing going on out there, right? So I did that for a little while. Well, I was just trying to get a job at Newsday. And the way I got a job at Newsday was this. They recognized my name because I was an athlete that was in the paper. That's the only way I got the job. The high school sports editors just said, oh, I know, I recognize your name. You want to be a sports writer? All right, cool. So I got a job, and all I did was literally answer phones. I didn't write for about 6 months, just answering phones, sitting at a desk. I'm telling you, when you're in your, you guys might be able to relate to this. I was about your age, you know, like 23, 24. I had a part-time job. That was my part-time job. It was at night. You get off the shift at midnight. So all your friends are working during the day and hanging out all night, and I'm home all day and I'm working at night, and there's nothing glamorous about it. It was just pathetic. And I did that for like a year before they finally started giving me byline. So it was like perseverance on top of perseverance. Like, nah, I think I really want to do this, but I never knew if I'd be good at it. So you learn about the business because as answering phones, you're also answering phones of other writers who are calling in, you know, sending in their stories. And through that, I kind of understood how everything worked. And then when I was sent out for the first couple of assignments, like my very first byline was high school badminton, 300 words in the newspaper. Like, and when I came out in the paper, man, I was like, cut it out. I was like, look at this. My name's in the ballot. Like, I'm freaking out about the fact that I had my name in the paper as a byline of a story. I could care less that it was about a badminton. Yeah, like, you know, who cares? You know, the only people that read that was like the kids who played badminton and their parents. No one else would have read it. But it didn't matter to me. It was a big deal. And so from there, it sort of became the next story, you know, the next story, the next story, until the assignments got bigger. And for me, it was sort of like, it was just the experience of writing, of being out somewhere. It wasn't glamorous. I mean, I wanted to cover the Knicks. You know, I wanted to cover the Jets. I didn't want to, you know, be sitting on the sideline of a soccer game, getting wet, you know, soaked in the rain and miserable weather. I didn't want to do that, but I knew I had to because I had to learn the business. I had to learn. I didn't have all the experience that others had as an intern. But because of my background as an athlete, maybe passion, maybe, you know, that I just, you know, stuck with it, and I read a lot, I just started figuring it out. And within 5 years, I had an offer to cover the to Alabama football and basketball down in Tuscaloosa. And I was about to take it. And when I told my editors at Newsday that I was leaving my part-time job, and I mean part-time job, dude, if I was bringing in 22 grand a year, like maybe it because I did some overtime. Like it was that bad. I literally for a while lived with my parents. Because I had to, I had no choice. And I was taking this job down in Alabama, and I told them I was leaving, and they were like, well, don't go yet. And now, oh, I didn't add this part. I know I'm rambling, but I really want you guys to understand like how ancient this whole story is, how far back it goes. Is when I was a part-timer at Newsday, one thing they told you is don't think you'll ever get full-time here. You'll have to go somewhere else first. Maybe if you wanted to come back, but you need to be experienced to get a full-time. Like if you want to do a pro beat at Newsday, you're never getting it coming out of the high school ranks. It's just never going to happen. So get your mind off of it. So I never expected. I just figured, well, I got to get out of here. And I got this job in Tuscaloosa. And they said, well, don't leave yet. I was like, well, it's a full-time job. I need to. Right before I was about to leave, they called me and offered me the Islanders beat. And it blew my mind. I was like, holy shit. This never happens before. So the truth is I was the very first part-timer to ever get a full-time beat. Now there's been others, Tom Rock, who covers the Giants. He was right behind me. He was the next guy they hired. And I always tell Tom, if I sucked, you would have never gotten that job. So I would tell him, you owe your career to me. But they gave me that beat mainly because nobody wanted it. But again, no job too small. I'll take it because I wanted the opportunity. So it started there. You know, and I mean, you guys know, the rest is history. I mean, I did the Islands for a bunch of years. They moved me to the Knick beat, which they knew I wanted. I did that. Then MSG, you know, off of my coverage and the way I covered the team and the popularity that I developed, wanted to add somebody to their broadcast that had a reporter background. Then they hired me. So I'd never done TV before. So I did that. And then from there, ESPN, you know, saw what I was doing, would use me as a guest a lot. And then eventually they just started giving me, you know, shows to do. So, you know, my first time on MSG, I didn't even know where the camera was. Like, I didn't understand any of it. Like, the guy would say, the director in my head, he's like, all right, on your single. And I'm like, what does that mean? So then he'd say it again, you're single. And I'm like, I don't know what that means. So then during a break, he's like, I told you you're single. And I'm like, what does that mean? He's like, you have a single shot of you. Your camera's right there. You got to look at it when you're talking. I didn't know that. I never went to broadcasting school. Like, I have no idea. So then the next, you know, after the next break, then he said, you know, all right, on your single. All right, now I need to talk to the camera. But I never knew that before. The first time I did radio, it was funny. I thought I was coming in to co-host with somebody who was a host. I came in, it was a Sunday night, and I see the board op and the producer. I was, all right, well, who's hosting the show tonight? And they said, what do you mean? I'm like, well, who am I on with? And they said, it's just you. I'm like, no, but I'm usually with somebody who's hosting. And it was a 3-hour show. And he said, no, it's you. So I called the program director and I said, hey, Justin, I'm here, but there's no one here to host the show. And he goes, yeah, I know. I have, it's your show. I've never hosted a radio show in my life. I never knew what to do, how to send it to break. I never knew anything. He's like, you'll be fine. Within the first, like most segments are about 10 minutes long, right? That segment felt like it was 4 hours. Like I was saying things and I'm realizing like, oh my God, I still have 5 more minutes to talk. Didn't know what to do. And then I was sweating, literally sweating 3 hours to finally get that show done. So it just shows you like my career path was based on opportunity that I took, and then I was a quick learner. I learned how to adapt, but it's only because I didn't have the background because the business had evolved so much in my time. I was comfortable as a writer because I was taught that. I wasn't taught anything else. So when you ask the question, how did you get where you are? I literally, my answer usually is, I have no idea. But it happened. But it's the lesson I would probably give you is try everything, no job too small, and always be curious enough to learn something about whatever it is that's going on. Because, you know, like, don't feel like, I don't know it, I can't do it. Or also don't pretend like you're an expert at something when you're not. Always be curious enough to learn, ask questions, figure it out, and watch people that, you know, you really admire. And you try to emulate them. And while you're doing that, you'll start to find your own voice. And that's sort of what happened for me. And that's really what's kind of led me here. It's been a meandering road. But it's not as simple as, yeah, I learned this, I went to school for this, I had this person who I networked with and they got me into this company and then I grew from there. It really wasn't like that. It was just someone said, I know you. And then someone else said, I like your stuff, we want to try this. And someone else said, hey, I'm going to give you this opportunity because I think you can do it. And I just took advantage of every opportunity that came my way.
Well, I can say this as a, you know, student who's ready to graduate in May. And a bit unsure of, like, you know, I have ideas of what I want to do. I would love to do something with radio or write, and I'm a big Yankee fan, so if I could cover a team like the Yankees. But I realized at 21, 22 years old, I'm not just going to get that opportunity handed to me. I'm going to have to start somewhere lower, if you want to say it, and then work my way up. Mm-hmm. But just, you know, coming from you, who's had so much success in this industry, to you know, say that, it definitely is more comforting to know that. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a matter of you know what you want to do. You have your sort of goal of what you want to do. And then getting there is going to be your own path and how you do it. You know, like that's generally how it goes in this business. And you're right, at your age, and I'll say this, and I don't mean it to be disrespectful, but you're not ready to cover the Yankees. Like, you're a Yankees fan and you know everything about them because you're a diehard. I was a Knicks fan. I knew everything about them. And in 1995, when I started at Newsday, I was like, I can cover the Knicks for you right now. I know everything about it. I know more about that team than your beat writer does. And it was true, actually. But I didn't know about the business and how you actually do the job. So to have all this knowledge is great. But if you don't know how to interview and how to get sources and how to, you know, how to manage people and manage your time and what, how to write the story and build the story, how to, you know, all those things that are part of the job that you don't even think about until you're there in the scrum going, holy crap, my head is spinning. So that's why I say you start small, you do small things, you learn, but you also have that curiosity of every time there's somebody doing something that you feel like, boy, that person's really good at it. Why are they good at it? Have that curiosity to watch them closely, and you never know. Like, it all kind of comes together.
Well, that's what I'm hoping for at some point in the future. I could, you know, maybe go on a podcast and talk to people and, you know, tell them my experiences. But, you know, I'll have to see. We can see what my future holds. But so I guess my next question for you is, what does it mean? Like you said, you always wanted to cover the Knicks. So what does it mean to be able to cover the Knicks on MSG? You know, have your own radio show for ESPN, and how has working for both of those media outlets, which are some of the biggest in the world, shaped you in, you know, who you are and as a journalist, as a radio host, you know, just all that put together? How, you know, how's that shaped you, and what does it mean to you?
What is working for both those companies mean for me?
Yeah. And just, you know, working like, within and what you do, you know, your role each day with it. And I guess more for like, what does it mean to you, like, for working for the Knicks, I guess, you know, meeting your dream, this is what you wanted to do.
Yeah, it's a cool thing. I mean, the first time, I mean, I've been to the Garden before, right, as a fan. I went to one Knick game in my life before I covered them. And the one Knick game I went to, I sat in the Blues, before they did the renovation of the building. It was the old setup of the building, and they were called the Blue Seats, which was the upper deck, the upper bowl, right? back against the wall, literally, watching Knicks Bulls. It was like 1991, maybe, something like that. So it was really well before the Knicks Bulls was a true rivalry. And, you know, that's my only time in the building to watch the Knicks. So the next time I was in that building to watch the Knicks, it was as a beat writer. So when I walked in for the first game, I noticed that the writers came in, and I you know, being on court level was, for me, like, I was awestruck. So the beat writers just kind of walk through the tunnel, walk out on the court, stand on the court. And I, like, walked through the tunnel. I was like, we're allowed to be here? Like, it's cool? Like, you know, it feels like I'm in, you know, like, honestly, like, you do feel like you're at the Vatican. Like, for me, that's how I feel. Like, you know, I'm walking in, and it's like, I'm in the cathedral. Like, am I allowed to go in here? Like, can I go up to that altar? Like, am I allowed? Like, it just felt like I was in sacred ground. Like, why are we just walking around like it's okay? And the first thing I did was go like this and looked up at the ceiling. And I just remember feeling like it was a holy shit moment. Like, dang, like, you know, wow. Like, this is really happening. Now, I'd been in the building for hockey, you know, covering the Islanders, covering the Rangers many times, but I'd never been ice level because they, you know, they don't practice there. So the games, the box was up higher. You were never down that low. So it was the first time I felt it the way, you know, like that. And it's something special that I'll show you guys. This is my laptop screen. Can you see it? So that's the ceiling, right?
That's awesome.
And for me, it's like a reminder. I put that's on my Mac as a sort of reminder of like that first moment I had when I walked in, and the first thing I did was just look up. And it's just a reminder of, remember, you know, where you came from. Like, don't ever get too big. So what it means to me is that it's like, it was a dream come true, you know, to even just cover the team and have a following like I did as a beat writer, to be on MSG, you know, to sit with a guy like Al Troutwig, to talk to Walt Frazier in a way now that I get to talk to him, fortunate to talk to him as if he's I consider him a friend, and have him constantly take his ring and punch me in the shoulder with it because he just likes to show, you know, championship ring, like, and he hits, like, you know, I can't even describe that. You know, Mike Breen is somebody that I just, you know, used to look at and think, you know, how cool is that? Guy went to Fordham, you know, and now he's covered, you know, he's a Knicks fan, and then he became a Knicks, you know, radio voice, and now he's the voice of the NBA. Like, just seeing, and now, like, Mike Breen, I consider him a friend. So that's all stuff for me that I still look at. I never take it for granted. The ESPN stuff is still kind of new to me because I've only gotten into the mothership, you know, the last couple of years. I was really with ESPN New York for the last, you know, 5-6 years, which is, it's in the company, but it's a separate piece. So you don't really feel connected to the brand ESPN. But this past, you know, year, since I've gone onto the national platform and I've done shows, you know, like First Take, and I've done shows, you know, like the morning show, I've been on all three channels that they have in different times. I've done SportsCenter. Yeah, that's still to me is like, wow, this is pretty cool. You know, like, this is awesome. But it keeps me curious, as I said before. It's to me, it's always that, who is that? Like, who you, you know, you identify somebody, Mike Greenberg, you know, you talk to him, and then you just start to watch and you say, okay, what makes him great? Because whatever he's doing, I got to figure it out, you know? And that's how I get. Maybe it's a competitive because I'm an athlete, or I was an athlete. I'm not an athlete anymore, but I was. And so that's how I get is, you know, okay, I know him. And he's the best. He's the voice of the network. So what does he do that makes him great? And how can I figure that out? How can I get better at it? So I think that's kind of what shapes me is the idea that each step you take, you acknowledge it, you are in awe of where you are, and then you understand, all right, you know, I'm in the forum now. So I've got to understand that this is how you have to conduct yourself. This is how the best do it. And I want to be among them. I want to be able to walk among them. So how do I do that? And I just keep learning.
Alan, I love that you showed us the screensaver for your laptop. I think it's really special as a Knicks fan to hear your story of, you know, how you love the Knicks and to get to where you are today. I just think it makes it more special when one of the two guys that's doing the post-game show is a Knicks fan. I think there's more passion in it. And now I think I'll see that even more hearing that, you know, going forward when I watch you. So that's great. But while we're on the topic of the Knicks, let's talk about them. You know, right now they're 5-3. They got a winning record this season, game and a half behind the Wizards. I personally have liked what I've seen so far, guys making improvements. But I want to know what you think has been really leading their success so far this season. You know, we've seen a lot of struggles with the Knicks, and I think this has been one of the more hopeful beginnings that I've seen in a while. So what do you think has been leading them to their success so far?
The three-point shooting is really the easy thing to go to. I mean, the way they shoot the three this year, and it's they picked up where they left off last year because although they didn't shoot as many last year, their percentage was among the best in the league. In fact, I believe tied for second best in the league by the end of the season. It became a weapon, and it's where the league's going. And so they started this season, they added a couple of pieces, and they're guys that shot three well to start the season. And when you have that, it's you can be number two in the league in scoring, right? When you can shoot the three the way they were shooting it. And they shot a very high volume. Now they've got to find a balance with that now. I think they got a little crazy at the beginning, and now they've got to have that balance because on nights you're not knocking it down, you got to have another way to score. But I think it starts with that. The foundation of defense is always going to be there with Tom Thibodeau. And I like that last year they established by the end of the season is a stingy defense, a tough defense, a rugged defense, a physical defense, a presence that they have with their bigs. You know, it didn't show as much in the playoffs. Obviously, they struggled with some things, but I don't think that was as much, you know, that was more about what they were missing, which is Mitchell Robinson in that playoffs, than it was anything else. I don't like their defense to start this season. I don't think they do either. But I feel like when you have a coach like Tibbs and you already know that foundation is there, it'll get better. They'll figure that part out. But they're just deep. I mean, they got their bench comes in and can drop, you know, 35 points on you. They got guys coming off the bench that can put up 20 and plus. You know, there's at least three guys that on a given night could get 20 off the bench. Not many teams can say that. So their depth, their three-point shooting, to me, are really two of the strengths that you saw right out of the gate with this group. And then R.J. Barrett, who's 21 years old, is in his third year and looks like he's ready to take that next step as a player. So they're a good team. You know, and you haven't been able to say that about the Knicks in a long time. Like, you used to say, yeah, they're pretty good. They could be competitive. You know, I was always cautious about some of the teams that they put together over the years. This is the first time since the 2012-13 team with all the old guys that they had. It's the first time since then where I could say, no, this is a good team. Like, they're going to be good, competitive every night. How far they can go, of course, I'm not sure. I'm never going to put them in the category of championship caliber because they just not haven't proven that. But can they be a team that's, you know, a playoff team, a contender, a team that, you know, every night they're going to be fun to watch? Yeah, yeah, I put them there. And there's a lot of teams in the East now that are like that too. So that, to me, creates what could be a lot of fun this season. It's already shown.
I'm no Knick fan, and I've gone on the podcast before. People might think I'm a giant Knick hater because I'm a Nets fan, but I am impressed with what I've seen from the Knicks from the middle of last year into this year. And yes, their defensive numbers are not where they were last year. I think you touched on it best, saying RJ Barrett's improvement from last year to this year is really what's driving the Knicks' offensive game to where it is. It's allowing Julius Randle to not have to give 110% every night. He can give 90-95%, but still dominate, but doesn't need to turn it up every single night, which really helps in a long season and then a postseason run. But my question is, besides those two, who is this X factor that the Knicks need to step up more to drive them into a deep run? Because right now they're probably a low to mid playoff team, but what are they missing? What's that X factor that they're missing right now?
Well, I mean, really what they're missing is if you're talking about what are they missing to make them a championship contender? Is that what you're asking?
Championship, yeah, but it's tough to say that to a top East team.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the thing. For them to be, if they're on top East team, that means they're a championship contender. At least that's how I identify it. They're missing a superstar. They don't have one. You know, Julius Randle was an all-NBA player last year. He's a terrific player, but I don't think anybody's putting him in the category of superstar. And, you know, I believe there might be only 10 superstars in the league, and I don't know if even there's that many. You know, so that means not every team has one, and some teams have more than one, right? So the majority of the league doesn't have a superstar. And everybody has their own star, their main guy. Julius is the Knicks' main guy. The Knicks' strength is their depth. That's their strength. They have two squads that are very good, and they even got some guys that don't even get in the rotation that could play in the NBA on other teams. So they, you know, they've got depth, but they don't have that, you know, that guy that carries you to a point where you look at that team and say, well, with him, you can win a playoff series, right? And that's what they're missing. How do they get it? Well, do they homegrown it when it comes to, you know, RJ Barrett? Does he just become one? Or do they trade for one, which is always the possibility because the way the league is, there's always that one star that just says, I've had it here, I want to go somewhere else, and boy, I like what they're doing in New York, or I like what they're doing here. So you always get yourself prepared for that, which I think they've done a great job being prepared for that. So I think that's what's missing. You know, what's now, what X factor for the Knicks is a different question that you asked, because it's more about what's the X factor that can make the Knicks a better team than what they are. And I think that's Mitchell Robinson, their center. I think he's been injured. He's still trying to get himself conditioning wise. He's still getting himself right timing and everything, because when he's on, he's a fantastic defensive center. He's an impactful defensive center, and he can change the game with his length, his ability, his athleticism, and also on the other end because he catches lobs really, really well. So I'm still waiting to see him take that next step and become the dominant, like a Clint Capella kind of dominant center that can change the game and also make the game easy on offense for his teammates, because when the double team comes, throw it at the rim, I dunk on everybody. And we see it at times with him, but then he gets tired real fast, and that's because he hasn't played in such a long time. So that's what I see. So what can take him to the next level? They got to do what your team did and attract a star or two. You know, that's what they've got to do. And until they do that, I think they have a nice team that's going to be real competitive, but they will, you know, you just can't expect them to be in that conversation of a championship team, because even like the Bucks, Giannis is a superstar. And he's homegrown, but he turned into a superstar. Chris Middleton was a really good Robin, a really good second piece. You know, that stuff is so important. And then they built smartly around him. So even that blueprint would be asking, well, does RJ become the Giannis in this conversation? Does Randall become the Chris Middleton in this situation? Well, RJ is still obviously miles and miles away from whatever Giannis became the last couple of years when he became an MVP. So, you know, all that stuff is still, you know, up for discussion. But that's really what it is. They're very good, but, you know, there's no Jimmy Butler. There's no Giannis. There's no KD. Or James Harden. You just don't have that. So because of it, there's no Jason Tatum either, if you want to even go there. There's no Joel Embiid. There's no Bradley Beal. So as I'm naming all these teams that have their superstars, you don't have that. And that's why, you know, you're not going to be in that upper echelon of the East.
So you kind of talk about that. You know, I'm a Bulls fan. So my Bulls went out and got DeMar DeRozan, Lonzo Ball. We traded for Vucevic last year to pair with Zach LaVine, which I was very, you know, excited and happy about. And you can see that has paid off, and they're starting to see success. The Knicks, we talked about, made the fourth – they were the fourth seed last year, right, in the playoffs against Atlanta?
Yeah.
Fourth seed last year. The Lakers, they won the championship in the bubble. Obviously, they got eliminated early with Phoenix. But my point is, some of these marquee teams who have struggled for the past couple of years are starting to be in the rise and hopefully become some of the top teams again in the league. How important do you think it is for the league that, you know, a team like the Knicks, the Bulls, the Lakers are now competing at this high level? Because you think about it, when the NBA back when Jordan with the Bulls, you know, Ewing with the Knicks, the Lakers has had so much history with, you know, from Magic to Kobe. I mean, how important do you think it is for the league to have these teams good again?
I'll answer that question because it's a great one in a second. But where are you from?
I'm from Connecticut.
You're from Connecticut. What made you a Bulls fan?
So, all right, funny story. I didn't really have a basketball team for a while, so I was a Bears fan. I was a big Brian Urlacher guy. So, and I'm a Yankees fan. So then I was like debating on the teams, and my brother's a big Knicks fan, and I kind of like doing the opposite of him. So I was like, you know what? I'm a big Jordan guy. I love Jordan. I said, I already like a few Chicago teams, so I might as well. And I, you know, and then I really like Zach LaVine, so I was like, I'll put together.
You're really confusing me. You're not nearly old enough to have seen Jordan play.
No.
Right. Brian Urlacher, just randomly, you just like Brian Urlacher. Just randomly.
Well, yeah. It
just was a random thing, right? Random. Just I like that guy. Like that's what you all right. I get it. Like you're literally growing up in the Patriots dynasty living in Connecticut.
Yes.
And you chose Brian Urlacher instead of Tom Brady. Is that what you're talking about?
I'm Southern Connecticut, so it's more Giants, you know, by me.
Southern Connecticut, don't matter. Like, you're all right, so you had the Giants and you had the Patriots, and you're like, let me go with Brian Urlacher. And that franchise that hasn't won a Super Bowl since 1985. Let me go with the Bears. So that's that one. But then on top of it, you decide, my brother's a Knicks fan, and I'm going to be that pain in the ass brother that's like, I'm going to go root for a team that was a rival of your team well before either one of us were born. Like, I'm going to do that instead. This is very confusing to me. And by the way, I don't know how you guys, Josh, Alexander, how do you guys even allow this to happen on your podcast? Like, this to me is, we should have started here. There's a lot to unpack with this whole thing. The Bears thing, the Urlacher thing, and then this random Bulls thing that has some Michael Jordan tentacle to it. That makes no sense whatsoever.
We've given up on him. He's a lost cause.
It really sounds like a lost cause. It really does. And then to say I'm a Zach LaVine fan when Zach LaVine's been there for what, a minute? Like not even
Derrick Rose. I would have respected the Derrick
and
Rose.
And that's the next thing I was going to say to you is like Derrick Rose, like that seems to be about in your age bracket where when he was great, you were like an impressionable little kid. That probably would have been the perfect time to be a Derrick Rose fan. And then I could say, if you said to me, you know what, Derrick Rose came and he became an MVP and they were just great. And I loved the way those teams played and Joakim Noah. And I'm like, you know what, I'll give you that. I'll give you that because that was a really good team, a bunch of tough guys. And I love Tibbs. I'll give you that. But you went Jordan with me?
Here's the thing. I never watched Jordan play because I wasn't alive, but I just love him. I just love the Jordan brand, and you know, then watching and like seeing all his highlights, yeah, and then his story and everything, and like the success, you know, he built. You know, I grew to like that. But also, I just love the Jordan brand so much. And then you know, I'm more of a Jordan guy than say LeBron or mm-hmm. these other guys. Okay. And then I love Prime D Rose. You know, I just. Not that it would be like a bandwagon, but everyone was kind of on the D Rose hype when he was winning MVP, and everyone thought he was
right. So you came around before all that. Is that what you're telling me? Like I was here during the baby. I was here when it was Jamal Crawford and Eddie Curry and Tyson Chandler. Like I was part of that crew. Like you remember when Jay Williams was a rookie on the Bulls? Is that what you're gonna tell me now? Like you remember?
No. I'm not saying no because I got into. My two biggest sports when I was younger was football and baseball. You know, I had my two teams. That was set.
Yeah, which basketball. By the way, here's the other thing, guys. Here's where you call him out now as a front runner. Because he is a Yankees fan. So it's not like he's going straight against the grain New York. Oh, all these guys that want to be New York fans. Well, I'm going to be the antagonist, right? Right. Stevie wants to be the antagonist. But you're not the antagonist. You went front runner. You went, well, let's see. Yankees dynasty, they won in 09, which is probably in your wheelhouse again of that impressionable kid. So, oh, Jeter, you're going to give me that whole thing. And then you went with the Bulls thing, and then you went with Brian Urlacher. This is very interesting stuff. Now, all right, I'll answer your question.
Well, let me add one more thing, if you don't mind.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because the Yankees are actually like, you know, my family's tough with sports because, you know, some of them are more Boston than some of them are, you know, like a certain sports and not others. But the Yankees is like the one team that, you know, my family all agrees on. You know, I like the Yankees ever since I came out of the womb. You know, like I was born to be a Yankees fan. Yes.
I got it.
You know, that was like, I went to my first Yankee game. There's pictures of me like 2 months old, you know, or very young. I forget how old, but like, I was, you know, probably didn't even speak yet. Gotcha. And then with the whole Brian Urlacher thing was I used to be a big WWE guy and John Cena was my guy.
There you go.
And he had the 54 on. So that's how, then I saw Brian Urlacher in Madden or, you know, on the TV with the 54, same kind of colors.
I got it.
So yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what though. We're not that dissimilar. So, I was born in the 70s, and my parents are from New York City. But my sisters were born in the city. But when I was born, my parents had moved out to Long Island. So we were watching. I was 7 years old. And we were watching the playoffs, the hockey playoffs, and the Islanders were playing the Rangers. And the Rangers beat the Islanders in 1979. And it was, you know, for the Islanders, they were the number one team in the NHL that year. They won the President's Trophy. And they failed. Right? They lost, and they looked devastated. And I remember, again, I'm just a little kid, and they were cheering and celebrating and just so happy. And I said, why are we cheering? And my mom said, well, because we like the Rangers. And I said, but we're from Long Island. We're supposed to be rooting for the Islanders. She said, well, no, we're from the city. We root for the Rangers. And I said, well, I was born on Long Island. I'm rooting for the Islanders. Now, it just so happened the Islanders then won the Stanley Cup for the next 4 straight years. So it was a pretty good time to jump on that bandwagon. But I always thought I chose that because I felt it was wrong to root for the city team. And that's why I did what I did. Now, they're also Mets fans, my parents. And, you know, they were all about the Mets. They loved the Mets. And I'd never understood that. So they have pictures of me in Rangers pajamas as like a little kid. They have a picture of me with a Mets batting helmet on. And it was 1978. Bucky Dent hits the home run against the Red Sox. My mother was a huge baseball fan, so we were watching. And I got excited, and then the Yankees went on to win the World Series. I had no idea they already won it the year before, and this was back-to-back. No clue. I was just, you know, I was 6 years old. But I just loved the Bucky Dent thing. I just thought it was cool. He hit it over this gigantic wall. So I became a Yankees fan. And she was livid because she's like, we're Mets fans. I'm like, well, I like the Yankees. Well, we're Rangers fans. Well, we're from Long Island. I'm an Islanders fan. So you see, like, I was doing the same thing. I was always going against the grain. The one thing they couldn't save me with, however, was the Jets. They weren't football fans. And I wasn't really a football fan, but it was something about Richard Todd in 1980 and 81 that just had me, you know, watching the Jets on Sunday. I just, for whatever reason, I like sports, and it was, they're the Jets. So one Christmas, they got me a Richard Todd, who was the quarterback of the Jets back then. He was Namath's backup, and then he became the starter. So they got me a number 14 Jets jersey. And so there I was, the AFC Championship game in Miami in the Orange Bowl in what now you guys might know of as the Mud Bowl. And a guy named A.J. Dewey had 2 interceptions off of Richard Todd, and the Jets didn't beat the Dolphins. And I've never been the same since. I've never been able to shake it. I became a Jets fan just because they bought me a jersey. It wasn't like any other reason. They could have bought me a Phil Simms jersey. I would have been a Giants fan. But they bought me a Richard Todd jersey. And from that point on, I'm like, all right, I guess I'm a Jets fan. And my very first year was the misery of the Mud Bowl. Think about that. And it's never been this, you know, it's been the same. I guess I should say it's been the same ever since. So, but I understand you going against the grain. Now, it's a long way to get to me answering your question. Yes, it's very good for the league. I've always believed, even though a lot of people want to say, you know, how small markets are very important to the life of any pro sports league, I think that's a bunch of bull. I mean, I think your major markets are what carry your sport. So when your major markets have good franchises, the whole league is lit, right? The TV, the broadcasters love it. The fans are bigger. The population of the cities are bigger. The attention is bigger. The stars are bigger, all that. And you were right. What you said is actually really smart. It's something I've said a lot. In the 80s, David Stern made a point that the NBA needed to have stars and needed to celebrate its stars. You had Magic in LA. You had Bird in Boston. You had Michael in Chicago. You had Patrick in New York. You had Barkley in Philadelphia. You see what I mean? Like, you had stars in all of these major markets that mattered. And when you had those stars and they all played each other, you know, Hakeem was in Houston. That's a big market. Like, you, it was important to have these major markets have stars because it allowed the game to get all the attention. TV, it just makes sense. If you have a team from New York and they're good and you put them on a national broadcast, do you think the ratings are going to be higher than when it's a team from New Orleans, which has a much smaller, right, population? Of course it's going to be that way. So I think it was smart. I think it's important, but they can't control the franchises and make them better. But I'll tell you what, having Zion go to New Orleans was not smart. Right? There's certain draft pick, like, really, that's where you're putting them there? Like, what are you doing? You know, why, you know, Shaq ended up in Orlando because, you know, they wanted Orlando, a new franchise, to get a boost. But what did Shaq end up doing? Going to LA. Right? I don't want to be in Orlando. I want to be where it matters, in the big time. So it's true. And I think the league this year, Philadelphia's back. Boston, as you know, has been good for years. Chicago and the Knicks finally kind of back into things, which is great. Washington, you know, I mean, they're a better team, and Bradley Beal's, you know, better. And LA is LA. I mean, you got two good teams in LA now, and you got two good teams in New York now. Yes, Josh, I actually said there's two good teams in New York. I know you're shocked.
Probably the first person to actually, like, say that.
Well, it's true, though. You've got, I mean, you know, I don't think you're getting a bigger bang. It's hard to believe. The Nets are a bigger national team than they are a local team. They get more attention nationally than they do locally. That's a fact. If the Knicks and Nets play on the same night and they both win, the Knicks are on the back page. But the Nets would lead SportsCenter, right? Because it's KD. Like, that's just reality. But it's good for the league. So it's a great question, a smart one.
And I have to say, you know, all these moves that these teams have made, really putting themselves back in the spotlight. It's been great as a sports fan just to watch the league evolve and see all these teams put themselves back on the map, like Chicago and New York. It's been great. But one of the things that I always find interesting is seeing how these moves that originally don't seem to be great end up panning out to be big in the future. So my next question for you, Alan, is what is a move within the past season or two that the Knicks have made, whether it's a draft pick or someone that they've signed, a move that fans were not really happy with or didn't really understand that you think 3 to 5 years down the road, Knicks fans will be saying, wow, that ended up being a really great move and giving us the boost that we needed?
It's funny. There's a couple of ones that I could guess on. There's a couple of ones I could explain. Like, I could give you three and explain them to a point where you'll believe me. But I think the one that will resonate the most is when the Knicks didn't win the lottery in 2019. When we thought, wow, Zion to the Knicks, Zion to the Knicks, Zion to the Knicks. Them not winning that lottery. Now, it would have been nice if they landed two because Ja Morant is just special, right? They land three, though, but it could have been a lot worse because if you remember that draft, the top teams all fell out. Everybody fell. The Knicks were the only team in the top five that didn't drop out of the top three. They stayed at least in the three. So they would salvage that draft by getting R.J. Barrett. Now, right now, R.J. and Ja played twice as many games as Zion has. And you could argue 3 to 5 years from now, it's better for the Knicks to have R.J. Barrett than Zion. Because in what you've seen from Zion so far, as talented as he is, does he look like a motivated athlete? Does he look like a guy that's all about, like, I want to be the best there is? Or does he look like a guy that just, A, gets hurt a lot, but B, really struggles with staying in shape and keeping himself in shape, being an elite athlete, right? So, I mean, he's probably like the same age as you guys. I mean, just, he looks like he lives like, you know, I hang out and I do a podcast. Like, he doesn't look like I'm a, you know, a pro athlete, right? Like, you know, you just see him. So that's when you wonder, if the Knicks had won that lottery, and there's Ja doing what he's doing in Memphis, and let's say New Orleans ended up getting RJ, and we see RJ now, you know, taking a step in a third year. Last year on a playoff team, he averaged 18 points a game. He's 20 years old, and on a playoff team, he averaged 18 points a game. I mean, you can't say that without saying, wow, that was pretty impressive. So if the Knicks had Zion and Zion only played 85 games in 3 years, wouldn't that be like panic? Wouldn't that be just a much bigger story than it is right now in New Orleans, right? It would be how the Knicks, you know, won the lottery but lost the lottery, right? Like, there'd be all these stories about the disaster that it is and this kid's never going to be great. I mean, it would just be controversy. It would be awful and be same old Knicks and all that stuff. So I do think the move you could talk about is them not winning that lottery and coming away with RJ Barrett, because it's a better situation for them than it would have been if they did win that lottery and got Zion, when you consider what Zion looks like right now, what he's going through right now.
This sounds way too familiar, just being a sports fan, because right now we're both seeing this as Jets fans with Zach Wilson being hurt. Even though it's not a big deal because it's a minor knee injury, just seeing how Mike White has played last week, there's so many ridiculous stories that are coming out because Zach Wilson plays in New York. The expectations, you saw Darnold, his 3 years with the Jets, expectations are just through the roof, and beyond that, just being in New York. So I totally agree with what you're saying about if Zion was how he is right now on the Knicks, oh my God, the Knicks franchise would just be set back even further than where they are right now. And the media would have a field day with it. My question is Jets related for you is, yes, the Jets started very slow, historically bad, recently, aside, putting this past Sunday aside, a very, very young team, rookie quarterback, rookie running back, a rookie wide receiver, defense is all brand new. Do you see promise in this team? Granted, it's a very small sample size. Rookie head coach, rookie everything. Do you see the promise with the foundation that Joe Douglas has built, or are you a little worried about some of the really bad stats that have come out of these games?
Rebuilding in the NFL is like the hardest thing to do, because it's such a brutal league when you are inexperienced. Like, teams just take advantage of you, you know, because wins are so important in the NFL. Like, you're just not going to have that. Like, when you rebuild in the NBA, it's amazing. A rebuilding team in the NBA can still win 20 games. Now, it's not a lot of games out of 82, but 20 games is still a lot of games to win against teams that are way better than you. But you can catch a team off, you can catch them sleeping, whatever. In the NFL, it's very hard to do that. A lot of people have criticized Joe Douglas with his drafts. You got to remember, he's only had two. You know, he's been here for three seasons, but he's only had two drafts. You know, they hired him after the draft, which, again, that made no sense. It hasn't been a disaster. The problem is a couple of his draft picks from his first year got hurt. And then you had a coaching change. So it's sort of like, well, maybe now that pick that was meant for Adam Gase doesn't fit the way Robert Saleh wants to play, right? You know, Greg Williams wanted this guy on defense, but it doesn't quite fit the way Robert Saleh wants his defense. So you got to factor that in. You factor in also, you know, Mims had all the stuff in the offseason. He really should be a dynamic part of the offense, but it took him a long time to get himself healthy after the food poisoning. He missed a lot of time in the summer. And, you know, while it's still curious that they wouldn't give him, you know, they wouldn't play him, give him reps, you can see when he's out there, there's times where he flashes talent and there's other times where he flashes an experience. Now, going beyond that, I give him like this, you know, I give him a pass because it's so hard to build and build young. He's been managing the cap very well. Mosley gets hurt. What a great signing that was. Lawson gets hurt this year, right? So Mosley gets hurt the first year, and he looked incredible in the first half. All right, like that first game against the Bills 2 years ago.
I believe it was on the first drive, he had an intercept, a pick six, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's just like he looked like a revelation, and then he gets hurt, and you don't have him for the rest of the year. And you could just see how that impacted their defense. Then he sits out last year. Can you blame him? I guess not. Then this year you're thinking, well, you got him, then you get Carl Lawson. Like, this is good. And Carl Lawson just in the preseason looked like an absolute monster, right? Achilles. That kills. Like it's just things like that that you can't control. The safeties are good. Corners that he found are very effective, right? He did a good job with corners. They're hard to find. He got corners. The defense has been rebuilt. Quentin Williams is starting to emerge. Franklin Myers was a great find. So they have the makings of something that if they could just freaking stay healthy and we could see it for a couple of weeks, it could develop, right? But there's potential there. Now, on the offensive side, Becton's been hurt. Nobody's talked about that. Becton was a fantastic pick. And not everybody thought he was going to be the best of the offensive linemen. In fact, I think two went ahead of him, right? In the draft. It was a
three,
smart pick.
Three, I believe.
Three, okay. Vera Tucker, fantastic pick. Look how he PFF grades him all the time. Every week it seems like he's one of the top graded interior linemen, right? Every week, and he's a rookie. So how'd that pick go? You know, they found pieces, and I really like what they found. Both Michael Carters, but Michael Carter, the running back. What a great pick. You know, like little things like that. You're saying these are pieces that if you give it 2 years, and everybody can stay healthy, God willing, you might start seeing the end results, but that's hard to do in the NFL. So I'm not, like some people want to jump all over Joe Douglas, I'm not ready to do that. Now, Zach at number two, that's the one where all summer, I mean, I should say all spring, and I was doing the morning show at the time with Keyshawn, and we spent a lot of time on the draft. We talked to all the draft experts. I mean, I talked to all of them, the Kuipers, the McShays, the coach. We talked to his BYU coach. We talked even with Trey Lance. We talked with Justin Fields. We had all of these people on going into the draft, getting all of the insights and watching video. We spent so much time on this. And every time I kept saying, are we sure? Like, are we sure? Trevor Lawrence, we knew. Given. Done. Knew it. Generational. But then after that, it's like Zach Wilson had the throw of the pro day season. And everybody talked about this throw that he had at the BYU Pro Day. And it was pretty impressive. But aside from that, any tape I had was like, who's he playing against? Is he playing against William and Mary? Like, who the hell is he playing? And it's that's different than the years before that when I was obsessed with the draft in 2018. And I watched every USC game. I watched every – Louisville I always am a fan of. So I watched Lamar. I saw enough of Josh Rosen to know no. And Baker was, to me, like the offense just made him look electric. But like I actually liked Mason Rudolph more than I liked Baker that year. But the one guy that kept jumping off the page to me was Josh Allen. And people are always like, how did you know? First of all, I have receipts. And I also have my wife who used to look at me going, what are you doing? It's Saturday night. What are you doing? I'm watching Wyoming football. Why are you watching that? Because this kid is going to be a pro, and he's really good. And I would watch Wyoming. I mean, it's sad, but it's true. And I loved them. So I was really psyched about that draft. There's certain players. So BYU's playing teams, and you're like, who are they playing? The same thing with Wyoming. Like, who the hell are they playing? You know, but it didn't matter because that kid just had that it. There was something about him. Now, Zach Wilson had a little bit of the it with the arm, you know, arm talent. But he was kind of small, you know, looked like a little kid. And so it always had me like, are we sure? Are we sure? Then we watched him in preseason. How good did he look? Like, he had moments where he looked really good. But once it got real, then I got real nervous. And I still am wondering, is he the guy, right? Is Trey Lance, is Justin Fields, Mac Jones, are they going to be better? Are they going to have better careers? Because you can't do anything about Trevor Lawrence, but you can about those other guys. I mean, is Davis Mills going to have a better career? You could say that. But right now, I think there's still a lot of questions about, okay, the arm talent's there, but where's the neck up talent? Is he ever going to put it all together and figure it out? Or is he just going to be one of these guys? Like, is he Johnny Manziel? You know, just less douchey. But that's what I'm worried about. So I can't answer the question about Zach Wilson, but I can say that Joe Douglas picked the guy that everybody said should go to. Everybody said he should go to. So it's not like he picked somebody, you know, it's not like Dave Gettleman, you know, when everybody's like, yeah, no, I wouldn't take Saquon here too. And he's like, no, I love him. We're taking him. Like, it's not like that, right? It's not like him saying, you know, well, I don't care what the experts say. I know what I'm doing. You know, Joe basically took what all the experts said he should take. So I still think we got to give him at least another year before we can start really, you know, coming down on Joe Douglas and his draft.
The whole talk with rookie quarterbacks is interesting because it feels like, I mean, as a Bears fan, feels like I cycled through, you know, quarterbacks with Mitch. I mean, now we got Fields. I'm high on Fields. But then it leads to my question. It seems like, you know, even Miami, Tua's been the starter for a year and a half.
Right.
Maybe a full year now. You know, half a season last year, half a season this year. And people are already like, all right, get him out of here. He's not
good. Yeah, they want the show. Yeah. Ready to ship him out and get to Sean. You're so right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Sam Darnold, same thing. Didn't really get the full, you know, oh, he didn't do good with Adam Gase. Get him out of here. Didn't give him a new chance with a new scheme, a new personnel. You know, same, I mean, Mitch had a little more time, but still, get him out. Or even with Justin Fields, he hasn't been succeeding like he did at Ohio State. And not too many people are saying that. But some people are like, oh, this guy kind of sucks already.
Right.
Do you think that everyone's so harsh? I mean, everyone expects these rookie quarterbacks to just take right off because a guy like – but even Patrick Mahomes, his rookie year,
Seth Mahomes didn't play.
He didn't play, exactly.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the rookie – like Justin Herbert ruined it for everybody.
Yeah, he did.
Right? Justin Herbert ruined it for everybody because he made it look so easy. He wasn't even supposed to start. Then they punctured the lung of Tyrod Taylor. He becomes the starter on week nine, and he never looked back. So I guess that's the problem is you get that. You get the Kyler Murray, you know, impact. You get some of these guys that do step in, and they just look like, you know, they're coming. Joe Burrow. You know, it just – they can handle it. But it's not for everyone. So I agree with you. You know, Tua, you know, you can see the flaws with Tua. You can. And a lot of times you can't afford to give him too much time because for coaches and GMs, the NFL is still about wins. And you could say, well, I got a young quarterback. It might take us 2 years. Good luck telling your fan base that that's 2 years of, you know, 3-14. I mean, nobody putting up with 3-14. You're 3-14 for 1 year. You're already on the hot seat. You're 3-14 for 2 years. You never saw the end of the second season. You're already out. That's just reality in the NFL. And sometimes it'll take a young quarterback more time. Ryan Tannehill is a great example. Everybody wants to say it's because he got away from Adam Gase. Is it? Or is it just that he had a bunch of years under his belt and he finally got healthy? And he had a team that it was a running game. Like, he didn't have to be the guy. Like, Gase was making him throw it all over the place, whereas Tennessee was like, no, we got a guy that can run the ball. You just think and dunk. So it all depends. Sam's a great example. The Jets didn't want to move on from Sam. They had to. Like, Douglas and Saleh talked about it, and Saleh said he was more than happy. If you want to stick with Sam and trade this 2 pick to somebody that's desperate for a quarterback and we could turn it into a bunch of picks and build up our roster, let's go ahead and do it. But Sam was already in his fourth year. They would have to pick up the fifth-year option and then still have to then come up with a contract off of that. And if he had a good year, you'd have to pay him a ton of money, right? So they just knew cap-wise it wasn't smart, so let's just reset, and that's why they did it. And Sam doesn't have Christian McCaffrey right now, so boy, he looks really bad without a talent like that. So Carolina certainly has the decision to make. But that's the reality of the NFL. And I'll tell you what, I don't know if Matt Nagy's around to see your boy develop into something. He already had one quarterback and couldn't get it done, right? So now are you going to give him a second chance now? I mean, I don't know. By the end of the year – if Justin Fields doesn't look like he's gotten better, might need a new coach.
Oh, I hope they do. I was a lot of people were trashing Nagy after that 2019 when the Bears first went to, I mean, 2018, you know, Mitch look like, I mean, he was technically, he was a Pro Bowler. He led the Bears to 12-4 record. Granted, the defense really led us to that. But I mean, you know, I was like, all right, whatever. I was like, you know, maybe Trubisky isn't the guy. You know, like, he just can't process the game as good as some of these other quarterbacks. Some of the throws he wasn't able to hit.
Right.
But then now, I mean, you're starting to see it's not just – it wasn't just Mitch. It was – it really is Nagy and Nagy's schemes. And Nagy's just so about him. And, you know, it worked in Kansas City. It has to work in Chicago. No, this is a completely different team. This is not Kansas City. This is not Patrick Mahomes, not Andy Reid and that team with all those weapons. This is Chicago.
A great example of that is the Baltimore Ravens – had Joe Flacco, and he ran one offense. And Lamar Jackson, they took like 30th. And they kind of took him, but they had him. But Joe Flacco was their quarterback. And Joe Flacco got hurt. Now, Lamar Jackson was not built to run that same offense, right? So did they just say, well, this is my system. You better figure it out. No. They had a whole other system built for Lamar, and it turned him into an MVP. That's how you cope. You know, it's what Andy Dalton can do is not a system that you have Justin Fields run. That doesn't make sense. You have to have, we just drafted him. I've got, it's April. We don't play until September. I got all that time, right? How many months is that? 5 months to come up with a system.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Specifically for Justin Fields, just in case he plays. In case we need him. They didn't do that, you know? And now they've had to add things and piece things in little by little, but it should be an offense built for him. That's what Baltimore did, and it was smart. So that, I don't like when coaches have one system, and this is what we're going to run, and you got to figure it out. You tell your system to the talent you have, not the other way around.
Well, that's why John Harbaugh is a great coach, in my opinion. That's why he stuck around in Baltimore for how many years, and that's why Matt Nagy, who won Coach of the Year a few years ago, is now probably on the top of the list for on the hot seat, and who and most likely should not have a job come. I mean, really, he shouldn't have a job. He should have, when he went on COVID protocols, just stayed home and not, you know, got his keys and went back to Hallis Hall. But, you know,
amazing how well they played without him, huh?
They played pretty good. Obviously, they didn't get the win, but for the most part, it wasn't without Khalil Mack, without David Montgomery. Right. Granted, Khalil Herbert looks pretty good. But for the most part, like you said, actually looked like a team that can move the ball downfield. I mean, of course, the defense decided to suck, but offensively speaking, Justin Fields looked pretty comfortable out there. Like I said, they moved the ball downfield. They actually put up 20 points, not 3, not 10, including a defensive touchdown. They actually, you know, so
–
but then they also just can't get a guy. They have to get the right guy, you know, and that's another thing with head coaching. It's not easy to find the right guy. Everyone just, well, you know, they got Matt Nagy because supposedly he was an offensive guru.
Right.
But clearly that wasn't the case.
Yeah. Well, you still need a leader of men. That's the other issue.
Exactly. So I'm hoping they find that. And, you know, because I would like to see these rookie, because I like this rookie quarterback class that came out of this draft, you know, with Trey Lance, Justin Fields, Trevor Lawrence, Zach Wilson. I thought it was a really talented group. So I hope they find that, you know, that success for them and those teams.
Mm-hmm. No, it's going to be interesting to see what out of this group, and I include Davis Mills in it, as 6 of them. I'd be curious to see what, you know, how they all do, because, you know, the class of 2018, you know, again, Rosen's not even on a team. Baker's, controversy that is, and you don't even know how long, you know, are they going to pay him? Sam's already on his second team. Right, it's Josh could be an MVP, and Lamar's already been an MVP. That's it. So this class, though, I'm curious to see the fate of all these guys and see who's still with his team, you know, 5 years from now.
This talk about rookie quarterbacks and panning out, and even backtracking a little bit to the comparison you made about Gettleman making a pick at 2 versus Douglas making a pick at 2, it all meshes nicely for my next question for you, Alan. So I'm a big Giants fan, and obviously this season's been a huge disappointment. You take away the injuries, it's been very tough to watch. And, you know, Daniel Jones was taken at 6, which, you know, I still to this day don't agree with. And, you know, that pick and some of the other picks and moves that Gettleman's made it's been very questionable. And, you know, there's been a lot of speculation going around of what the future should hold for this team and the personnel. So my question for you is, do the Giants completely clean house and rebuild, or do they hold on to Judge? Because, you know, he did bring a new philosophy to this team, and he's one of those coaches that you want to play for. But the way that he's handled some things and the way he's been addressing some issues in the media makes me skeptical. So you think, you know, Giants should still hold on to him, or just clean house completely and start fresh?
Yeah, I don't think he's a coach you'd like to play for. I never got that vibe from players who played, you know, been through the Giants organization or know him. I feel like if you're going to move the GM, you got to move the coach. Now, if you're the owner, let's see, after TC left, you've had McAdoo, right? Shermer.
Yep.
And now, so that's 3 in 7 years, 6 years, whatever it is, right?
Yep.
If you do the math, that's basically you keep a coach for 2 years and then get rid of him. That's not good. So if you're an owner, you might be hesitant to make a move. But if you are looking to clean house, you got to do both. Because if you only get rid of the GM, you're going to hire a GM that has to keep the coach. Not many quality GMs will want to do that. Because what we know is what will happen is you'll bring in a GM. He'll say, oh, yeah, I'll take the job. I'll keep the coach. You'll wait a year, and then he'll fire the coach. I mean, that's how it'll go. So then you're still going through a transition. Doesn't make sense. So if you're going to make the change, you make the change wholeheartedly, or you just stick with what you've got, and you just hope that they are healthy. Because the one thing that if I was Judge and Gettleman that I would say to Mara and Tish is, how can you judge us when look at all the injuries we've had? Right? How do you judge us when we never had Saquon, where our receiving core was always banged up? Nobody was ever healthy. How can you judge us? Look at the quarterback. Look how well he's played. He looks great. He looks like he's going to be a franchise quarterback. So we nailed the quarterback, but unfortunately, he's never had his weapons to really show what he can do and help us win. So it's not fair. So you can make, I mean, I can make a strong case as much as I don't want to. I could easily make a case. Like, here's what they do. So First Take is like this. First Take, when you're on First Take, they send you an email. And they send you all these questions. And then you have to and it's all anonymous. So like when you reply, you're replying without knowing what anybody else is replying. So there are questions. Like Alex, if you ask the question, should the Giants clean house? It's either yes or no. So it's yes and then you explain, or no and you explain. Now, a lot of times if you agree on something, but they love the topic, they'll come back to you and say, well, you're all agreeing on it. Could you make a case for the other side? And you just become like that lawyer. So if you want to, you're like, yeah, I can do it. All right, so now I'm on national TV fighting with somebody about something I really don't like. I think the Giants should clean house, but because I want to entertain everybody with the debate, and I want to also just talk circles around like Keyshawn or Stephen A. All right, so I will make my case on why you should keep them. And that's what I would do. I would how many injuries, how many guys were hurt, what you saw, what you didn't get to see, and it's how can you really judge a team on this? And you know, that whole thing. You're gonna have 2 draft picks in the first round, you know, to continue to build off what you already have, blah blah blah. Right? There's so much that you could make the argument for. But I wouldn't believe it myself. I think they should clean house, because I just don't feel like they've got the right leadership there. And it has nothing to do with, like, when players are injured, when you take undisciplined penalties in a game, when you jump offside twice and it costs you a win. You know, those are things that's coaching. That's all. That's, that means your players aren't really dialed into you, aren't really locked into you. And he, you know, I also think he's terrible at the podium. Terrible. And all that stuff matters in New York. It does. So should they clean house? Yes. Will they? I don't think they will, because John Mara's history has shown that he's been quick trigger lately, but I feel like he's might be hesitant to do it again because they've changed so much that you might be able to sway him into saying, and obviously Tish is the money guy, to give me one more year.
I think Alex had his ears covered for that last part, because he's been saying for God knows how long on this show that Gettleman needs to go. And as of late, with the way the Giants have been playing, Joe Judge should be following. So you guys are in the same.
I agree. Yeah.
I think at this point, almost every Giant fan is. Seeing how Joe Judge is at the podium is just questionable. Some of the discipline penalties that you talked on is just ridiculous. That Washington game, easy win for the Giants.
Well, even the headset deal, the whole situation with the headset.
Yeah, the headset, that makes no sense.
Well, he's lying.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's the problem. When you get caught lying to a point where even the league's like, yeah, no, you've never complained. We've never found an issue. So I don't know what you're talking about. Like, the fact that the league would call him out publicly about something like that, it says a lot. It says a lot to me. But I just wonder, because they've spent a lot of money and they've gone through a lot of coaches, if Mara just says, no, not doing it. Because, look, I'm always one on. I never like calling people's jobs. I don't believe in it. I don't believe in saying people should be fired unless I have a solution, unless I say this would be a better way to go. And I just truly believe that the Giants need a change in philosophy, but they need to bring back, even though Gettleman is from the past, he's not really. What the Giants always represented was like this idea of like dignity in the way they did things. George Young, I mean, it was just, Ernie Accorsi, there was a certain dignity about them and about the organization. It was a classic, flagship franchise. You need that kind of a personality, yet what also the Giants represented was a toughness, but it wasn't like Joe Judge talking toughness, right? It wasn't that kind of, it was more of a, just an air of toughness. The guy that I think they should hire, give him the keys to the franchise, like literally, like, here, it's your house. Who do you want to hire? Who do you want to bring in? I'll believe in you. Is Lewis Riddick. He's been in the front office. He's been a player, but he's obviously he's been in the media now. He's doing, he's on the biggest stage doing Monday Night Football at this point in his career. But if you've ever listened to him talk, he's classy, he's dignified, but yet he's very tough. He's very smart. And he knows a lot of people. He certainly knows the league. He studies it, everything. He studies the league inside and out. So how would you not want to have a guy like that as one of your frontmen? And then trust him to know he probably has a good understanding of who the right kind of coach for today's players would be and how to find them, right? Who could you get that you bring them in, and that's a good coach? Instead of we're swinging for the fences on getting an offensive, like the offensive coach thing became, the hot commodity. Let me bring in a guy that just has this great offense and it's all going to work out, when you pay no attention to the fact of whether or not he can lead people or not. Like, Adam Gase is one of the worst leaders in the history of sports. Like, he might have he might be able to sit in a room and break down offense and break down systems and make you go, wow, this guy knows his stuff. But if you ask him to lead, there's a whole room of guys that the minute he starts talking, they're just like, what the hell is this? Like, we've all played for coaches that we know, like, you're not inspired by them, right? Like, we've all had that coach and he starts talking and you're like, yeah, my face, man, I'm not listening to you. Like, we've all had, and that was Gase. But owners are billionaires. They don't understand this stuff. Lewis Riddick would, because he played. He gets it. So I feel like you give him the keys, I'm sure he'd have a short list already of guys that he could identify as coach. And I actually think experience in New York is more important. Sean McVay's are great. It's great to find those guys, the Sean McVay's, the Brandon Staley's, right? Like, those are great guys to find. But really, in New York, in a market like this, where you're facing the media constantly, where you're under scrutiny, you've got to have somebody that's been there before, that understands. Like, McCarthy would have been the right fit, although he would have been murdered for all his clock management stuff. But you just need to have somebody like that, that doesn't look weird at the podium, that won't lie at the podium, that isn't going to double, to like, you could tell is unsure what to say. You got to have somebody that's very confident in how they speak, that can handle it, that's been there before, and it would help if he's got a ring on his finger. You know, those things all matter. And that's that to me, if you're in New York, all of your teams should have something like that. Like what, like, you know, what changed for the Knicks, not to bring back the Knicks conversation, but when people say, well, like, what's different about the Knicks? There's one thing different about the Knicks that they haven't had in years. And one thing is the coach. It's been years since they had a coach that when he speaks, all the media, they all acknowledge this guy's smarter than I am about this sport, right? And you might think, like, of course he is. Every coach, but you understand, as writers, when you're around the league as much as writers are, there's times when coaches talk and you're like, this guy's full of shit. Like, you just don't believe anything he's saying. Because you know he's just, that's how some guys are. But when Tibbs talks, you're like, yeah, he gets it. He knows. He's been there. He's been in the wars. He's been around, right? Barry Trotz comes to the Islanders. They go from a team that is sort of, you don't take them that seriously, fairly competitive, to like Stanley Cup contender every year. Why? This Trotz got a ring on his finger. He's been in the league for 20 years. You know, like when he talks, everybody believes him. You know, like that's just reality. So I think, you know, the Jets got Salah. I like him, but, you know, he's still inexperienced as a head coach. I just think in New York, you got to have people that have been there. The Mets, when they hire a manager, don't bring in some other dude that's never done it before. Rojas looked overmatched. Callaway had no idea what he was doing, right? You can go down the line. But when you bring in somebody that's done something, it changes everything in the franchise. So, you know what, Alex, that's what the Giants need. The Giants need to bring in somebody that's been there before, that has built something. Whoever it is in the league that you identify as a great coach, blank check, get your ass to New York, become a bigger star than you are wherever you are. That's how you got to do it.
It's funny that you say It's funny that you say Lewis Riddick, though, because, you know, I'm a big fan of his, listening to him on NFL Live Monday Night Football. I mean, like you said, the dude knows what he's talking about. Yep. And I just, for whatever franchise, you know, whether it's a team like Chicago, New York, whatever, I mean, this dude should be in a front office right now. And I think, and whatever team finally does, hopefully give him the check and say, please run our team, they're going to see great success. And I would like to see it maybe be Chicago this year.
Well, you know what? There's going to be a race for it. I just think there's a lot of guys in all sports who are phonies. John Gruden, phony. Like, there's a lot of guys who are phonies. And there's a lot of guys that are legit. You want to have the guys that are legit. You know, like that. You got to have those guys. And the McVays of the world, they're Haley's Comets, man. It's not like, oh, we got to find the next Sean McVay. Maybe there's only one. It's very rare you get that, right? That doesn't happen all the time. You know, the Eagles are trying to get Sirianni. They're hoping that he'll turn into that, you know, next bright young coach that'll be successful. But I there's nothing better than a resume. People say retread. I say resume. You know, the Bruce Arians of the world, like these guys, man, like when they become available, snatch them up. Andy Reid's, Pete Carroll, you know, like when you got to snatch those guys up because they know nothing but winning. They know nothing but winning, right? And that's what you got to do.
You are just saying everything that I think everyone's been agreeing with. Nothing you said was wrong. And I do think Salah could be the right coach for the Jets. I love how he's
approaching. I hope so.
I love how he's approaching the media. It's been years since we've seen a confident coach with the Jets. Rex Ryan was the last one. Rex Ryan was very confident when he spoke. The players respected him, loved playing for him. Results weren't there, so it's tough to see with Salah.
Well, they were in the beginning. Yeah, the Rex thing fell apart when they let, you know, Tannenbaum, you know, moved on, and things fell apart for them. But, you know, but yeah, you're right. I do think the podium stuff it's very important. It's not overrated.
So before we wrap up, I do have one last question for you. It's a bit of a curveball because it's not sports related. It's about our sponsor, Liberty Shirt Co. someone that we are very close with as their sponsor, and we know that you are close with them. They make your shirts. We see how you look in them on air. You look great. So just talk to the listeners about like what they mean to you, what their shirts are about. Like, why do you choose Liberty?
Well, it's A, the quality. B, you know, your dad, Mark, I mean, he's one of the best people I've ever dealt with when it comes to this kind of stuff. It's not easy. You know, a lot of people see us on TV and it's always, you have to look right. You know, it's funny, when I first started doing TV, I didn't make a lot of money. So I was buying off the rack. And when you buy off the rack, it doesn't fit the same. It doesn't look the same. And what I never realized was, if you don't look right, you're going to distract people. And I've gotten tweets where it's like, you know, if I didn't get my hair cut, it's like, you know, some comment about my hair, how ugly your tie is, you know, how that doesn't match, or you're wearing the wrong pattern, or your tie clip is too high, or, you know, you should have a pocket square. Like the first year I did TV, the tweets I got about appearance, it was like, I never realized how people actually got fixated on it, but I realized what you're doing is distracting them from what you're saying because it's bothering them. So I had to put more emphasis on, you know, dressing better and spending more on that. And I used to just do the white shirt thing all the time too. But then I realized that also, now you're being boring, you're not being colorful. So Mark was the guy that helped me the most with it because, you know, he showed me patterns. He would tell me what matches, what looks best, what looks good for you. And I got smarter and smarter with it just from his expertise and what he knows. And so it only made sense, knowing how much passion he puts into what he does, to make someone like me or the guys on NFL Fox, make them look great. Like, I listen to everything he says. I have 24 shirts, I think, from him. And I have three more coming that I can't wait till they show up, because I just saw him and they got a couple of patterns that he's got for me and I'm fired up for him. But I will say it is true. I'm not making this up. From wearing those shirts, the comments went from criticism to compliments. Simple as that. Just because of the how well made the shirts are, how well fitting they are. The patterns are beautiful. The color's beautiful. How everything matches. And it's not me. It's the advice I get on what to wear with what. So it's easy to be loyal to a brand like that when they put so much energy and effort into what they do.
And yes, I am a little biased. That's my dad, as you mentioned. But no, but Alex could also attest. He was wearing it at work today. A lot of people, like you said, the Fox guys, they are always posted about it because they love it.
Josh, where's mine? Where's mine? Is it in the mail?
We'll get you a Bulls shirt.
There we go.
But Alan, we want to thank you for stopping by. It was a great interview, spreading a lot of knowledge, wisdom, everything. We really appreciate what you had to say and your insight. Thank you for stopping by 3P Podcast. And thank you all for tuning in.